everyone, there's only so much time in the day. That's why we edited this Vermont Edition podcast for brevity. I know you'll thank us.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's a Monday, which normally isn't the day Vermont Edition holds its weekly health update, where we get updates on all the COVID-19 news in the state and give you a chance to ask questions that are on your mind about the virus and other health issues. But we expect the next several days at least to be a little unusual because of the Senate impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump, which will change our ability to broadcast Vermont Edition after tomorrow's press conference. So we wanted to make sure you had a chance to get your questions answered today instead. We are joined, as normal, by Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. We're going to talk about school sports and the rules around the resumption of games later this week. And we'll also look at other extracurriculars, like a key meeting of stakeholders tomorrow to go over how to allow in-person music classes. And we'll look at case numbers in southwestern Vermont, how the state is testing for new strains of the virus, and other issues that are important to you. Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan, welcome back. Thanks for being with us on a Monday.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I'd like to start by talking about the high numbers of cases in southwestern Vermont, because I think that is alarming, certainly to people who live in that part of the state. So let's talk specifically about Bennington County and Rutland County. In Bennington County, there's additional testing being set up. Can you tell us where and how and why and who should get tested?
Sure. And so we do have additional testing set up in Bennington County. In terms of location, I'll have to go to the website and find out the exact location. But the why is because we continue to have some high numbers coming out of Bennington, disproportionately high to its population. And we're not able to pinpoint an exact source, which makes us believe that this is just a widespread community transmission that's happening in a variety of sectors and environments in Bennington. And so we're really trying to emphasize, A, get tested. Even if you haven't been at a social gathering, or even if you're not sure if you're at higher risk right now, we're really encouraging anyone to get tested. That will allow us to identify someone early who is positive and quickly get the right information to them so that they can isolate and we can quickly reach out to their contacts.
Are the testing numbers in Bennington County similar to test numbers around the rest of the state and you just want a higher concentration?
From what we understand, the testing numbers in Bennington are not different than the rest of the state. However, we do know that we're not testing at the full capacity in terms of the spots that are offered.
Why would there be so much more community spread in Bennington County than the rest of the state if you cannot pinpoint specific locations or outbreaks? Why do you think there would be more spread there?
You know, it's interesting. We were just on a call with the local hospital this morning and having some of these same conversations. And we think it might be just a variety of things happening at once. There were some social gatherings earlier in the year, which may have, spawned the beginning of some of this spread. We also know that Bennington County is similar in terms of case rates to its counterpart in New York, its neighbor, and so it's people possibly coming over to work and coming back, and so we may have some spread coming that way. We also know that ski areas may be contributing, although we're not certain of that, but certainly we know that people coming back and forth from a higher prevalence area could be contributing. So there isn't a clear one way to pinpoint this, but we do anticipate that it will ideally go down if we've got more people testing, if we've got people really paying attention to what we're talking about in terms of prevention. But right now we don't have a clear answer except to say that it may be through a variety of pathways and likely is through a variety of pathways.
So what's being done in terms of outreach to ski resorts in specifically? Because I think a lot of people are concerned that that may be one pathway where the virus could be coming in on asymptomatic carriers. And it sounds like the health department believes that could be a contributing factor as well. So what kind of work needs to be done with ski resorts to make sure that people are actually following the rules?
Sure. And I would want to just first state that we're not sure that that's the main piece. That could be one contributing, but we certainly know simply even outside of the ski industry, it's on the rise in Bennington. But to speak to the ski piece, we are offering testing at some of the ski resorts, and we're encouraging more testing. We've got people encouraging people to test there. We're increasing staff workforce testing at the ski resorts and encouraging testing for skiers as well. So those are some of the things we're doing now to see if we can get a handle on the surveillance and to find out what might be happening there.
Would the state reconsider its rules around what ski resorts are allowed to do and not do, and the fact that skiers have to attest to the fact that they have quarantined if they're coming in from out of state, but there's no real proof that they have to offer and no way for ski resorts to necessarily enforce that?
Yes, and Jane, I may have missed the first part of your question. I'm sorry. It appears that you're cutting out a little bit.
Oh, sorry. Yes, it's our connections seem to be a little weak today. I was just saying, is the state thinking about reconsidering any of the policies around skiing that the state and ski resorts have come up with for this season, given that ski resorts are supposed to ask skiers if they've quarantined, but there's no real enforcement mechanism, nor is there any way to prove that skiers have actually done it if they attest to it?
You know, we've really relied on kind of community cooperation, significant messaging and education. And so we're continuing to do that. I'm not aware of any change right now in any of that policy, but we're hopeful that some increased testing will give us a better sense. And hopefully, if necessary, we'll give skiers and the ski industry more information to see if they would like to do anything different or if we need to do anything different. But right now, again, we're not certain that that's a really key piece to these increases. We think that's one pathway. And so testing there, but also just testing in the community at large and really promoting more prevention work. You know, it's really the 6 feet apart and uncrowded spaces and the masking is so important.
You mentioned that Bennington County's case rates in sort of mirror the case rates in the neighboring New York County. Why is that the case, though, for other neighboring counties in Vermont and New York and Vermont and New Hampshire, where they seem to balance each other? Or is that specific to Bennington County?
It's been called out specifically for Bennington County. I'd have to look at the case rates in all of our other counties. It's not always the case. Certainly, we've had plenty of times when our county's case rates, and mostly they are in Vermont, much lower than our neighboring county's case rates. But in this case, we are seeing this. I don't know if there might be increased flow of workers coming back and forth across the border. And again, you know, some of the other opportunities around tourism and skiing could be the case there. But again, we don't have firm answers. This is all, you know, a situation we're studying, and we don't have clear answers. And so we're continuing to investigate and to examine this.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at those cultural factors. But, you know, you can think about places like Plattsburgh and Burlington, which perhaps doesn't have quite the same. But there are a lot of people who come over from New York and work in Vermont in other places than just southwestern Vermont, and certainly the Upper Valley, which is sort of a cultural unit in many ways. And there's a lot of flow between New Hampshire and Vermont for work and sometimes school and shopping and all kinds of other things, medical visits. So it's interesting to see that. Let's talk about Rutland County a little bit as well, which hasn't gotten as much press, but is really experiencing a significant volume of cases. I know there was a hospital outbreak, but what's going on in Rutland County?
Yeah, the hospital outbreak was, you know, was something we were looking at in the last couple of weeks. But again, we're seeing some widespread community transmission. I mean, I think that's the shift that we've seen in the last several weeks, is that we are having fewer large outbreaks for the most part. And where we are seeing rises, it appears to just be coming from community transmission. So we're looking more closely at Rutland now to see if there might be additional social gatherings and connections that way through our case investigation. Sometimes in case investigation, we start to unearth some smaller outbreaks that might be contributing. But at this time, we're seeing community transmission.
Is there a plan to offer additional testing in Rutland County?
Yes, we'd like to increase the testing in Rutland and in Franklin. However, it's not a lack of testing that is the challenge right now. We do have testing, and we have testing spots available. And so it's really encouraging people to take advantage of that testing that's available. So again, if you've been to any social gathering, if you're doing anything that you think puts you at slightly increased risk of COVID infection, we encourage you to get tested. Unlike before, we actually do have testing capacity in the state. And if you call, you're likely to be able to get an appointment very soon. So we would encourage anyone, but particularly in Franklin, Rutland, and in Bennington, to reach out and get a test. It will help your community. It will help you, obviously, if you know and find out that you're positive. And it really allows us to hopefully contain quickly any kind of spread that's happening there with the isolation and the quarantine.
Yeah, Franklin County over the last 14 days has had 210 new cases, Rutland County 314 new cases, and Bennington County 281 new cases. Those are the highest case numbers in the state other than Chittenden County, which is, of course, the most populous county in the state, which has had 398 cases. And I'm not sure whether that has been updated for today or if those are actually, I think it is updated for today. So those are the results of 14 days as of today. So really high case rates there. Remarkable then to see as we look at that that sort of western edge of Vermont that there have been 76 cases in Addison County, which of course had a large outbreak around the Christmas holiday, just after the Christmas holiday, but cases there seem to have gone down significantly.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were speaking about this on Friday. It really tells us that it's somewhat unpredictable where we're going to see case rises, especially now that we do have more community transmission. You know, when we do well, we do well across the state. So generally we see numbers go down, but then we see these pockets and it's not always precipitated by one particular event, which I think just tells us we need to be very cautious moving forward, especially as we have vaccines becoming more available. It can lead subconsciously to people becoming a little more complacent because there is real hope on the horizon. But of course, as we see, it doesn't slow down this virus right now among an unvaccinated population. And that's what we're seeing.
Are you concerned about the Super Bowl? Well, let me rephrase that. How concerned are you about the Super Bowl and the potential for gathering?
Yeah, I didn't catch all your question, but I think you're asking about concern around the Super Bowl. And yes, I mean, we're concerned anytime there's a long weekend, there's any kind of event that brings people together. We did put out some messaging around the importance of not gathering together with people outside of your household in order to watch the Super Bowl game. And I think a lot of people paid attention to that. But again, probably not everyone. And so another reminder, if you went to a Super Bowl gathering that was outside of your household or with people that you wouldn't normally gather with, please go get a test. It will really help you, really help your community, and allow us to contain it if we can catch it early.
Let's go to David, who's calling in from Wilmington, not Williston, Wilmington. David, hi, go right ahead.
Hi. My question is, I've read numerous articles saying that the coronavirus causes numerous side effects, both horrific and long-lasting, possibly even permanent, even after recovery from the virus. Why would anyone want to risk injecting the vaccine into their body, even though it's a weakened version? And can you guarantee that it won't cause the same side effects, whether it's weakened or not?
Deputy Commissioner Dolan, the vaccine is not a live virus. Can you talk to David's concerns, though?
Sure. The vaccine is not the coronavirus, and it's not an attenuated version of the coronavirus. So you're not injecting the virus into your body when you're receiving a vaccine. You're triggering an immune response, and you're teaching your body how to respond to the instructions as though the virus is attacking you, but you're not actually injecting virus into your body. So there really is no danger in terms of the same kinds of effects you might get from having coronavirus long-term. So you've probably heard that some people who have had COVID-19, once they recover, some of them have this long hauler effect. There are no concerns around a long hauler effect from contracting COVID from getting the vaccine, because the vaccine won't give you COVID-19. What it might give you are some symptoms that mirror that. Like, you know, you may get a slight fever, you may get a sore arm. Sore arm appears to be a common side effect. But for the most part, this appears to be a very safe vaccine. We've got clear evidence on that. Here in Vermont, we're seeing very few reactions, and we have a very good system set up where we're screening. So anyone who has had an anaphylactic response to the vaccine in the past doesn't get the vaccine. But otherwise, we are seeing a really safe rollout, and the studies and the trials all give us a lot of confidence.
Can you explain why someone would get some of the symptoms, you know, just for people who are concerned, who say, okay, but why would I get an achy feeling? Why would I feel wiped out after getting the vaccine if it's not a live virus? You know, so can you explain why people are going to possibly have reactions? And some are fairly strong reactions, certainly not to the extent of what COVID-19 could do to you. But you can feel some pretty strong reactions sometimes to vaccines.
You can, yeah. And that's your immune system actually responding and building up the response that it needs in the case that you come in contact then with the actual virus. So it's actually your immune system working for you. So anyone who gets the vaccine, your immune system will respond and begin to build an immune response to that particular virus that the vaccine is targeting. The difference is for some of us, when our immune system builds that response, we may not feel it at all. For some of us, we may feel tired, we may get a fever, and that's really your body fighting back against what it perceives as possibly a weakened version of the virus, but in fact isn't. And so it's your immune system doing its job. So when your immune system responds, we know it's doing its job. Sometimes that can be a little scary because you may not feel well. And you're right. In some cases, it can be more than just an achy arm. You know, we've certainly seen some people feel really tired for a couple of days, but for the most part, these reactions are mild, but they are a sign that your immune system is working and ready then in the event that you were exposed to the virus in the future.
Karen in South Burlington says there's a group from the Vermont National Guard who are leaving for Djibouti in Africa in a few weeks. I'd like to know why these first responders are not enough of a priority to receive the vaccine prior to their departure.
Well, it's not so much that any particular group isn't important or essential or a priority. What we're really looking at as we roll out the vaccine is, who do we need to vaccinate in order to save lives and in order to decrease hospitalization? And our data is really clear that 90% of deaths in Vermont have happened among people 65 and older. So there are many, many deserving, important populations. And if we had enough vaccine now, we'd like to get at everyone right away. But we are limited in our vaccine, so we have to make hard choices. And this is a hard choice, but in some ways a very clear choice for us in Vermont. We know who's been getting sick and who's been dying, and that is the age group that we're targeting first.
But you also have targeted first responders of many different kinds of first responders, including volunteer firefighters, including EMS workers, hospital workers, people who work in long-term care facilities. And I'm not questioning that, but I think the question would be, wouldn't National Guard members, especially those going on deployment for the security of this country, who may be exposed in other countries to other countries' rules around COVID-19, why wouldn't they be prioritized as first responders along with other first responders?
Thank you. Thank you, Jane, for reminding me about our first group 1A. Yes. So we did first vaccinate as per CDC guidelines and as per our own priorities, our healthcare population, people who are dealing directly with patients, doing patient-facing healthcare interactions, and first responders. And so we made the choice to select that group. For the most part, the National Guardsmen, who are first responders, of course, in that way, were able to get vaccinated if they were first responders in a patient-facing mode. I don't believe that these were patient-facing first responders, and so that was the key. First responders who may be in a situation where they need to provide health care. And I'll have to look into a little bit more what the National Guard program is. I believe some of these programs are actually governed by a federal program, but I'd have to check into that. But our 1A population was around health care, patient-facing.
We have a note from Allison in Colchester who says, I want to know what the governor plans to do about people breaking the rules his government has created to help stop the spread of the pandemic. Clearly, they're not working, as our numbers have yet to decrease since the fall outbreak. The way I currently see it, there are two types of people, those following the rules and those who are not. The rule followers are burning out. We've been living in isolation for almost a year now and are losing any incentive to continue doing so. The rule breakers are continuing to live life to the fullest. I see out-of-state friends skiing in Vermont, knowing full well they have not quarantined prior to arrival. I personally feel the state needs to either strictly enforce the rules established or loosen the restrictions. What do you have to say to Allison, Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah, this is a tough one, and I can understand frustration. There's a lot of people who feel like they have been following all the rules way back since March, and to see some other people not follow the rules feels frustrating. And all I can say is you're doing the right thing by following the rules, because so many people are, and many, many people are following the rules. We do have lower rates in Vermont. We have lower numbers of deaths in Vermont, although every death, of course, is a tragedy. And so we are doing better than a lot of the country. And that is because so many people are following the rules. And I know it's hard to see people not following them. In terms of enforcement, it just becomes very difficult to enforce on an individual by individual basis. You would have to have an incredible public safety force out there with enforcement. We could get constant tips on individuals or businesses, or I see somebody over here, or a skier showed up and I don't think they're that they're quarantining. It gets really challenging to do that. And so I know that the governor, of course, hears all of these concerns. And I know he's trying to weigh how do we keep people safe with also how do we manage to keep our communities feeling relatively comfortable and not having a heavy public safety presence. And then there's just the practicality. Even if we did have the public safety presence, I'm not sure how easy it would be to track down and enforce individual by individual. So not an easy answer there, but really encourage people to continue to do the right thing. And we'll continue to educate and encourage people who aren't following the rules to begin to follow them or to follow them more often.
Let's talk a little bit about school-based sports and youth league sports. Games are allowed to resume starting on the 12th on Friday for teams to play each other. That has not been allowed. Scrimmages within a team have been allowed prior to this, and the state says it's been looking at how those have been going, how practices have been going, and determined that it is safe to resume interleague games. But there are rules, only 2 games per week, which I think actually may have already been a rule, but there have to be 3-day gaps between games. No spectators are going to be allowed. There's trying to be some accommodation to allow for videographers or some way for people to be able to spectate from beyond the actual location of the game. Referees and officials are going to be required to wear masks, as are all of the players and coaches. Can you describe a little bit about that 3-day gap? We got a question from Toby who says, Toby's looking for clarification regarding high school sports competitions and says, in the governor's press conference, it was said that, quote, teams will be limited to no more than 2 games in a 7-day period and must schedule at least 3 days in between games. So do Monday and Thursday games work, or Tuesday and Friday? Or is that only 2 days between games? So Monday and Friday games would work, or Tuesday and Saturday games? Toby's wondering what is actually counted as a 3-day gap.
And so I would need probably someone to check the guidance and find out what the full 3 days is. I don't know if that's clearly defined. I can understand how someone might think Monday, Thursday would be 3 days, although I wonder if it's a full 3 days. The goal behind this is to first still continue to try to minimize how much face-to-face we have, but also to give enough time that if we were to start seeing problems, we may be able to step in and make adjustments as needed. And so I think the goal is twofold there, to try to put some sort of frame around how often people are getting together, and to give us a little bit of catch-up time if we needed it, if we started to see problems developing in terms of transmission. But again, I don't think I have a clear answer on is 3 days Monday, Thursday, or is 3 days Monday, Friday. So, Jane, what I might be able to do is get an answer, get it back to you, and maybe you'll be able to post it.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that. Because, yeah, in thinking about it, if it has to be 3 days in between, that would be Monday, Friday, but then you couldn't have another game on Monday. So then it would be Tuesday, Saturday, but then it would be Wednesday, Sunday, or Monday. You know, it's like you can't actually get the same days per week if it's actually three days in between. You'd have to be staggering the games, and you'd really only get 1.5 per week, kind of. So, yes, at any rate, maybe we can get some clarification on that. That would be great. There any other school sports rules that I didn't mention that we should be talking about?
Those were the big ones. I think people are pretty excited to be able to play again. And again, you know, just want to caution people to please follow all the rules. While we do know some transmission can happen during a sporting event, we know some of the transmission happens before and after with other social activities. We've seen that also at the colleges, for example, where we sometimes have an outbreak and it's not so much during the game possibly that the transmission occurred, but once teams start getting together more, they start having social functions. Let's have a potluck, you know, let's all get together after the game. And that's where we get people feeling more casual, taking off their masks because you're not publicly playing a game. So it's really those areas too that we'd encourage people to be careful with.
Secretary of Education Dan French said on Friday at the weekly press conference that dealing with music, trying to figure out a path forward for in-person indoor music classes was one of the hardest issues he was having to deal with. And he mentioned that it was because of the expelling of breath that comes from some of the instruments that are being played and how to handle that for people who you can't wear a mask when you're playing a trumpet. Why is that harder with music than with sports when people are also expelling a lot of air and breathing very heavily, in this case, indoors in close quarters in competition?
Yeah, it's a good question. The music sports challenge has been coming up a lot. And I think we're having a meeting. I think you mentioned also that there is a meeting coming up to discuss this and figure out more information. We're trying to look at any of the evidence and the science around this to see what is safest. But we do know early on, you know, of course, there was the very famous case with the choir, mm-hmm. Where one choir session caused an incredible outbreak and many deaths. And so since then, not just since then, but music has been looked at very closely, also playing of instruments with the spit coming out as you blow hard in some of these instruments. And so we do know there's a higher risk there. Is it higher than sports? Well, you know, in sports, you can have the masks. We have more data from the sports side. I don't know that we have as much data from the music side because it did shut down so quickly. So again, they're going to meet and look at this overall. Because we have relatively low transmission in schools, I think there is an interest in trying to open this up somewhat. I know kids are really missing their music programs.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that it's fair to say that some, you know, music and drama aficionados, students, music teachers and parents feel like, pardon the terrible pun coming up, that, you know, these kinds of extracurricular activities have really played second fiddle to sports, that the focus has been on let's get sports back. Let's make sure that people can play sports. A lot of attention, a lot of focus, and a lot of work being done to make sure that they can figure out how to get sports back safely. And sports play a huge role in so many people's lives. But so does music, so does drama, so do these other extracurricular activities. And there seems to be a sense that some people have that that just really hasn't been a priority for the Agency of Education and the Health Department in figuring out how to address these mental health needs of these other extracurricular activities that play such an important role for young people.
Yeah, I would agree that the mental health impact is the same regardless, right? So this is about, regardless of the activity, how do we connect young people with something that gives them comfort, that they love, that stimulates them, that provides, you know, an opportunity to feel good about what you're doing in an environment where you don't get to gather with other people and you don't get to do so many of the other activities you can do. There's no doubt. And certainly I wouldn't want to suggest that sports are more important in terms of mental health to young people than music. And so I think that's one of the reasons we're going to look closely at it this week and make sure that we are giving it the priority it needs. I do think there was some sound science as much as we had behind it at the beginning. And now we're going to continue to look at it again, because our transmission rates are relatively low in schools. That also may allow us some changes here.
Let's talk about vaccination. And listeners, again, if you have a question about COVID-19 news, health updates, new strains that are being tested to see if they're in Vermont right now, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Leslie is calling in from BB Plain. Hi, Leslie. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a 61-year-old female that has developed a severe lung disease within the last 9 months, requiring high doses of steroids, which makes me very compromised to the nth degree. And I'm hoping that they're going to be having plans to incorporate people such as myself with that are compromised in maybe the age group at least of 65 and older. And I'm hoping there's good news in that, as far as that goes.
Leslie, thank you for your call, and I'm sorry to hear about the development of your lung disease. So, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, what the state has been saying is age bands first. 75 plus is the one we're in now. We will be going to 70 plus before the end of the month, we've been told. Then 65 plus, then people with certain underlying health conditions of any adult age group, 18 or 16 up through 64, will be able to be eligible for the vaccine after that. Leslie's wondering if someone like her, who's older but with a significant health condition, might be able to be prioritized in an older age band.
Well, thanks for the question, Leslie, and I can hear you struggling as you speak on the phone, and so I'm sorry that you're going through such a hard time right now. And I know that the advent of the vaccine brings a lot of hope, but it also brings a lot of anxiety to people who feel like it's here now, and I'm sick, and I'm worried, and how do I get in as soon as possible? And unfortunately, for some folks, even in that situation, we are requiring them to wait a little longer. Again, we really are having to stick with the data. We're not able to personalize this approach individual by individual. And so the data tells us that 90% of our deaths happen in 65 and older. So that is what we're sticking with. But once we finish the 65 and older, we will be moving into the chronic conditions, and lung disease will be one of those. We've got those listed on our website. And so I am hopeful that anyone who meets those definitions for whom COVID infection could mean very serious or critical illness would be part of that chronic disease group. And I'm sorry, Leslie, that you're struggling right now. And I wish we had enough vaccine to move more quickly. We are seeing what we think is an increase in our allocation. And so what we thought could be months might be shorter than that to get to the chronic disease phase. As we see more vaccine manufactured and come out, we will hopefully be able to move much more quickly because we are poised to surge in our capacity to vaccinate more people so we can get to all of the people who need it so critically.
I want to ask about that in a minute, but first let's go to John, who I think wants to address what we're talking about right now. John's calling in from Richmond. Go ahead, John.
Yes, other states are prioritizing high-risk residents under the age of 65. Why can't Vermont do the same? And the question for the commissioner, if you had two parents, one was 60 and had COPD, cancer, kidney disease, and the other was 65 in perfect health, who would you want to go first?
So let me ask you this, John, before we turn this over to the deputy commissioner, because we've now heard the state say it's stated reasons many times that it's looking at the data. It's showing that primarily the deaths have occurred in older people, and then going down the list to those who have compromised immune systems from a variety of reasons who may be vulnerable, that the state says it's doing this because this is what the data shows that is the best approach to saving lives. Do you disagree with the data or the approach, or you're just, you know, concerned because of what you see in your own life?
Other states are making different decisions. I can't believe that their data is all that different than ours.
So, Deputy Commissioner?
Thank you for the question. And again, recognizing it is really hard when you're seeing your parents and seeing that they may not be coming up, you know, very soon to be eligible for vaccination. We are looking at what the other states are doing. We feel really confident in our approach that it's the best approach. Obviously difficult in that we can't get at everyone. Some other states have opened up, for example, 65 plus broadly. And what we're hearing in those states is that because it was opened up in that way, the youngest of that group are getting vaccinated more quickly, in part because they may be more tech savvy or have more ability to get transported to places. We're seeing long lineups. And so while other states are making different decisions, I think what's hurting some of those states is that because they opened it up so wide with so little vaccine, they're still taking a while to get to their oldest population. Here in Vermont, we have reached almost 70% of those 75 and older, or we are reaching through our current scheduling. And so we feel like that's the right thing to do, even though it's difficult. I know other states have made other decisions, but we have tended to do very well in this response compared to most other states in terms of our infection rate, our mortality rate, and now our administration rate is also quite high. But we are in constant discussion with other states to see what they're doing. If they are getting it out more quickly, why are they getting it out more quickly? I was just on the phone over the weekend with the deputy commissioner in North Carolina, finding out what their plans are. So we're talking on a regular basis and, you know, to do the best decision making we can.
Laura in Versher says, I'm wondering what's happening with homebound elders and vaccines. I know the state is, quote, working with EMS providers, end quote, in trying to make this happen. But are there more details? I am a volunteer EMS provider in my town, and my colleagues and I would love to know what we can do to help.
Thanks for the question. And a quick follow-up on the earlier question about National Guard. The National Guard are actually vaccinating their own personnel through a direct federal allocation.
Interesting.
So the Department of, yes. So now back to our homebound.
So I'm sorry. So people who are, yes. Is that all National Guard members or just people who are members who are being deployed?
It doesn't indicate. So the feds are actually running the vaccination program. They may have their own prioritization within the Guard, but it is not through our state allocation. And so the feds are in charge of their own policy. And I'm not sure what their policy is around their own National Guard, but they've been doing that through their own program.
And that goes for people who get their health care through the VA as well, right? Those, they may have different eligibility protocol.
That's right. Yeah, both of those groups, both the National Guard and the VA, are both with separate allocations through the feds and have their own priority policies there.
Got it. Okay. And so now to Laura's question about homebound senior citizens who can get the vaccine in some cases through local EMS providers.
Yes. And thanks for the question. So we had been waiting up until several days ago because we were waiting for information to come back from the CDC about transporting the vaccinations when the vial is open, because you have to open up a vial and sometimes just bring a small amount to someone's home. And so the CDC gave us approval finally to transport and that it would not affect the safety of the vaccine, which is great news. So we are now working with home health agencies first. The home health agencies have identified and have the lists of patients who would be eligible due to the homebound nature of their situation. And either a home health agency will directly vaccinate through their own vaccine allocation that we give them, or an EMS provider will come in. And so the home health agencies are reaching out to their clients as the vaccine becomes available and as we bring on each home health agency, and they will set up the times with each person, and either EMS or the home health agency will come out. So if you are part of a home health agency and a client, the home health agency will reach out to you to set up your appointment.
All right. So the state you mentioned is getting more doses. I think you said expects to get, but my understanding is that we're already getting significantly more doses than we were several weeks ago. And Governor Scott said last week that the state will essentially, I think from this week on, be getting about 22% more doses than it was 4 weeks ago. Why aren't things moving faster? Why haven't there been announcements about updated schedules for those in the other age bands, given that we apparently know and apparently already are getting significantly more vaccine doses than we were when this original plan was made?
So I anticipate that we will probably have an announcement later this week or next week about opening up our next age grouping. We'll wait and see what the date is that the governor announces on that. But we do anticipate that with more vaccine, we're able to move more quickly now through the age groupings. And so we are poised and ready to expand as needed.
But isn't that in the same timeline that was already expected, about 5 weeks?
Yeah. I don't know that we've received 22% more this week. I believe we received 5% more last week, and I believe the announcement was 22% more. So I would have to check our numbers on that. But basically, we're not hoarding vaccine. As soon as we get it, we are administering
it. I think it was already 16% higher, and the additional 5% over the 16% made it about 22% over what we were getting maybe a month ago.
Yeah. And so what we're doing is, if people have late vaccinations well out, we're able to pull those back if we need to. But we're also able to open up the next age group in a timely way. And so all I can say is, as vaccines come in, if we have enough to open up sooner, we certainly will. Our goal is to move this as quickly as possible. And so you should be hearing announcements soon about opening up the next age grouping.
How many people in the 75 plus age range have gotten their first doses?
That's a great question. I might have to get that answer for you. I believe it is about 10% in that age range have gotten their dose already. Let me get back to you, Jane. I'll have to look at the numbers. I know we've scheduled 35,000, and I will have to check and see how many have already gotten it. So I'll check on that and get back to you.
Thanks. And I'm looking at the state's COVID-19 dashboard, and I ask you only because that's not going to be necessarily specific to So right now, according to the COVID vaccine dashboard, it says 24.2% of Vermonters who are age 75 and above have already gotten one dose of the vaccine. But I imagine that tally includes those who were in Group 1A, who are in senior living facilities, who would have gotten that dose earlier. And so, you know, I'm asking you because it seems like the state is not moving fast enough to really pick up speed to get everybody vaccinated, even in that 75-plus age band, in a quicker timeline to then get to the 70-plus. I mean, we keep hearing about additional doses, but we're not seeing more vaccine reflected, like a really fast ramp up reflected in the data points. Now, I know people made their appointments already, but aren't we going to have to pick up the pace if we're going to get people vaccinated, even on the timeline the state has laid out?
Yeah, so some of the places that the additional vaccines are going, for example, we're continuing 1A that will stay open. And so we're learning in some hospitals that people who had been vaccine hesitant are now interested. So we're able to get vaccine out that way. So we've actually increased our allocation back out to hospitals for 1A. And then as new vaccine comes in, again, we're moving it as quickly as we can. And so we will likely see an overlap of the group 70 plus with some of the vaccinations for 75 plus. And so as we open up 70, if we have slots available and vaccine, which we will, even earlier in that 5 to 6 week range of people who had been taking appointments, we'll backfill those in with 70. So you'll see an overlap with each age group, and we're able to back that up earlier when we have more vaccine. I'm very confident that as we get more vaccine, we're getting it out. And our administration rate is quite high. I believe it was at 70%. Last time we spoke, last Tuesday. Sometimes there's a little bit of a lag depending on the day. So if it arrives when we receive a shipment, you'll see a little bit more of a discrepancy in our administration rate because that's the day it's arrived. But as we then move toward the end of the week, just before a new allotment arrives, you'll see a high percentage in terms of administration. So we're feeling comfortable with our administration rate and with the pace. Again, obviously, we would like to see more vaccine. And as it comes, we're able to scale up with our capacity. We have hospitals coming on board to increase that capacity. And we also have capacity with other partners should we need to go to a significant surge.
Cecilia in Cabot says, I know for a fact that my aunt, who was in a nursing home battling pneumonia, became unresponsive 12 hours after receiving the Pfizer vaccine on February 2nd, and she died on February 5th. I would think this constitutes a possible adverse effect, but I've not heard anything about any adverse effects of any of the vaccines other than anaphylaxis, which this was not. Have any adverse effects from the COVID-19 vaccine been reported in Vermont?
There are a couple of ways to report. So one of the ways to report is through the VAERS system, which is a federal system. And that reporting mechanism allows anyone to go in and report based on self-report what they see as an adverse reaction. So somebody who is in a long-term care facility who has other illnesses, may pass away at any time. If they pass away 12 hours after a vaccine, an autopsy would need to be performed to determine whether or not that was seen as an adverse effect of the vaccine. And so far, we have not determined that there have been any deaths as a result of the vaccine. Sometimes things happen around the same time or soon after, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's a cause and effect. It might simply be that something's happening at the same time. And so there's an association of time, but not necessarily of cause and effect. And so far in Vermont, we have not seen any significant adverse effects in that way.
Okay. So, we also got a note from Catherine in Rutland who has a different kind of vaccine question. Catherine says, I'm a nurse with a practice in Rutland. We're trying to determine what additional protocol changes we need to make regarding COVID-19. Since we've all been vaccinated, are we still required to test 25% of our staff on an ongoing basis? We know about 5 to 10% may still get the virus post-vaccine, and the same amount of people can be silent carriers. Is the state's position that we test all staff on a weekly basis?
So we are continuing the testing requirement for staff while we wait for staff across Vermont to get vaccinated. Of course, many are already. We're at a pretty good vaccination rate. I think 70 to 75% of healthcare workers We're continuing that testing, but we are reviewing it as we move along now. We do know that some other states have made some adjustments in either testing requirements or other requirements. So we're continuing to review that. But right now, given where we are and knowing that there's still some 1A out there to get vaccinated, we're continuing our testing at this time. Yes.
The state is working in partnership with outside organizations to do genomic sequencing to determine if any of the variants that have been identified for COVID-19 are in Vermont. When do you expect results?
Actually, we expect some results today from the first grouping that we sent out to Massachusetts. And we've got some more genomic sequencing happening this week. And so we'll expect those results ongoing. And then we'll be doing it on an ongoing basis. We anticipate that it's already here and our results will likely show that.
And by you mean what's been termed the British variant? Or do you also mean other variants, including the variant identified first in Brazil and the one in South Africa?
Yeah, so I guess I shouldn't have said it because we're looking at, we're testing for a variety of variants. So we anticipate that there are probably variants here in Vermont already, and we expect that we will see those results as results come back in. If not today, then in the coming weeks.
How would knowing a variant was here change state policy?
If we know a variant is here, you know, we'll be able to share that with people. We're hopeful that people knowing that there's a more transmissible variant here will encourage people to practice more of the prevention messages, masking, 6-foot spaces, uncrowded places. I mean, that's really the key. The variant doesn't change our advice, but we hope that it becomes a more intense message with the variant. And so that will be helpful to us. And then we would determine, is there anything we need to do differently in an outbreak situation? For example, if we know transmission is higher, is there anything more aggressive we'd want to do? And we don't have answers on that part yet.
Is the state doing this testing because it believes the federal government has not done enough of it?
Not necessarily. I think the federal government has been taking some samples. We're doing it because we want to know more about what's happening in Vermont. I don't really have a statement on whether or not that's because the feds aren't doing enough, but we would like to have a handle on it and have control over the timeline so that we can do this as needed.
Is the state paying for this testing?
Yes, we are.
That's Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. Deputy Commissioner, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.